Following are comments on Shakespeare's Henry V, Chorus, and Act 3. The threaden sails borne with the invisible and creeping wind draw the huge bottoms through the furrowed sea. Henry V's fleet sails to France, and once there he readies his siege of Harfleur. When negotiations fail, the siege begins. The chorus to Act 3 informs us that Henry has set out from England for France and made his way to the French port town of Harfleur. England, says the chorus, has been left largely unguarded since all the young men made their decision to follow Henry to France. Chorus 3, lines 20 through 21. A siege is building against Harfleur, and King Charles VI has offered, through his ambassador, quote-unquote, Catherine his daughter, and with her, to dowry, some petty and unprofitable dukedoms. Chorus 3, lines 30 through 31. Henry rejects this offer as insufficient to justify his efforts. It's a great pleasure to hear the music of the third chorus, such as the precision and fineness of Shakespeare's language, encouraging us to let our imaginations swell with the fleet's sails. His chorus tells us to see, quote-unquote, the threaden sails borne with the invisible and creeping wind, draw the huge bottoms through the furrowed sea, breasting the lofty surge. Chorus 3, lines 10 through 13. This tableau is worthy of Homer in the Iliad and the Odyssey, a master of nautical description surpassed by none. So, too, the chorus's picture of, quote-unquote, a city on the inconstant billows dancing. Chorus 3, line 15. For there is none of you so mean and base that hath not noble luster in your eyes. King Henry gives a stirring speech to his troops as they stand ready to storm the town of Harfleur that they have been besieging. In Act 3, Scene 1, we hear Henry skillfully using martial rhetoric to stir up his troops for the coming fight. Quote unquote, for there is none of you so mean and base that hath not noble luster in your eyes. I see you stand like greyhounds in the slips, straining upon the start. Act 3, Scene 1, lines 29 through 32. Henry apparently sees the unifying force of military endeavor. It can make the mass of low-born men he beholds into something extraordinary, connecting them in ways they hadn't imagined and giving their lives a higher purpose. While Henry's rhetoric may be sincere, he may well see his men as pure fighters in the same way that he might see greyhound racing dogs as evincing pure desire to run. It's fair to ask whether any of his men ever saw the fruition of the promise that the king later makes in Act 4, Scene 3, before the climactic battle at Agincourt, namely that, quote-unquote, he that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. Act 4, Scene 3, lines 61 through 63. We must place such stirring rhetoric entailing social betterment next to the quote-unquote, vile pistol's ignoble realism in the current play, or Falstaff's crass admission in Henry IV, Part 1, that few, if any, of his hand-picked, quote-unquote, ragamuffins will escape beggary when the fighting ends. It isn't as if late medieval England, or any other country in that age, had a Department of Veterans Affairs, or offered returning soldiers the well-deserved benefits of a GI Bill, like the one enjoyed by America's veterans when they returned home from Europe and Asia at the end of World War II. I must leave them and seek some better service. Bardolph, Pistol, Nim, and a boy quit the storming action against Harfleur, but Captain Fluellen catches sight of the men and forces them back into action. The boy confesses that he considers his adult masters cowards. In Act 3, Scene 2, we hear Bardolph excitedly, if probably not honestly, screaming, quote-unquote, on, to the breach, Act 3, Scene 2, Line 1. But neither Nim nor Pistol is keen to take him up on the suggestion. Nim complains, quote unquote, "For mine own part, I have not a case of lives." And Pistol sings a tune beginning with, quote unquote, "And sword and shield in bloody field doth win immortal fame." Act 3, Scene 2, Line 3, and Lines 7 through 9. Fluellen soon catches sight of them and drives them back into the battle. This brief scene also gives us the perspective of an ordinary servant who pins Nim and Pistol as cowards and thieves, saying, quote unquote, "Three such antics do not amount to a man." Act 3, Scene 2, Lines 28 through 29. All of these base actors the boy knows well offer only words, not fighting skill or spirit. What he says of Pistol will stand in for all. Quote unquote, "He hath a killing tongue and a quiet sword by the means whereof he breaks words and keeps whole weapons." Act 3, Scene 2, Lines 30 through 32. As for theft, well, the boy says, quote unquote, "Nim and Bardolph are sworn brothers in filching." Act 3, Scene 2, Lines 39 through 40. The boy's final judgment of Pistol, Bardolph, and Nim is succinct. Quote unquote, "I must leave them and seek some better service. Their villainy goes against my weak stomach, and therefore I must cast it up." Act 3, Scene 3, Lines 45 through 46. Young as he is, he doesn't want to hitch his wagon to their dishonorable star. Shakespeare, with his concentration on men such as Bardolph, Pistol, and Nim, and on a servant boy, gives us a sense of the muddiness or complexity that accompanies the heroism of even the grandest military campaigns. The underbelly of war consists of fierce doubts, anxious hopes, and desperate bids to stay alive. Heroes larger than life and self-conscious parasites share the field with those who are just trying to survive. As with any complicated endeavor, motives abound and they conflict when those who act upon them cross paths. Shakespeare wants us to reckon not only with the big picture that writers of historical narrative generate, but also the seldom told individual perspectives, fragmented, biased, and partial though they are, that can only be conjured with one's understanding of human nature as the starting point, at least when the events in question happened lifetimes ago. But this isn't to say that Shakespeare subscribes to a facile relativism. The servant boy's outing of Pistol and Nim as frauds demonstrates that at least sometimes it is possible to cut through the rhetoric and tell the truth. "For look you, the mines is not according to the disciplines of the war." The Welshman Captain Fluellen, ideologue and military historian extraordinaire, lectures Captains Gower, Jamie, and MacMorris on battle tactics, and then gets into an argument with MacMorris. In Act 3, Scene 3, the Welshman, Captain Fluellen, prattles on about military method. Quote unquote, "For look you, the mines is not according to the disciplines of the war," he says to Gower. Act 3, Scene 3, Lines 4 through 5. Fluellen is a military historian of sorts, but quarrels with the Irish Captain MacMorris when the latter tells him that, quote unquote, "It is no time to discourse." Act 3, Scene 3, Line 46. See also Lines 31 through 35. MacMorris leans into a quarrel with Fluellen, saying, quote unquote, "I do not know you so good a man as myself. So, Christ save me, I will cut off your head." Act 3, Scene 3, Lines 70 through 71. Fluellen, for his part, seems flummoxed by this kind of talk. Fluellen is courageous, but he's also a pure ideologue in his love of war's professional side. He is loquacious, has a comic Welsh accent, and ends up talking sometimes while others are fighting. Even so, his vehemence, signaled by such expressions as, quote unquote, "Look you now," and, quote unquote, "In your conscience," is honorable. Fluellen speaks from an excess of erudition, uprightness, and national pride, not from unworthy motives. Still, the danger in his erudition is that it could lead its possessor to rationalize the bloody chaos human beings visit on one another. Will you yield and this avoid, or guilty in defense be thus destroyed? King Henry threatens Harfleur with utter destruction if they won't yield. Harfleur's governor admits that the town is, quote-unquote, no longer defensible, and Henry accepts the surrender. In Act 3, Scene 4, King Henry harangues Harfleur's defenders, acknowledging war's stark violence with the shocking advice, quote-unquote, take pity of your town and of your people whiles yet my soldiers are in my command. Act 3, Scene 4, lines 28 through 29. The speech as a whole bristles with references to primal violence. Quote unquote, the fleshed soldier, rough and hard of heart, in liberty of bloody hand shall range with conscience wide as hell, mowing like grass your fresh fair virgins and your flowering infants. Act 3, Scene 4, lines 11 through 14. Mass rape is threatened again in the same speech. We are told that if certain conditions are not met, quote unquote, the gates of mercy shall be all shut up. Act 3, Scene 4, line 10. As for the outrages to follow, Henry twice poses a question that smacks of moral insanity. Quote unquote, what is it then to me? Ellipsis. Act 3, Scene 4, line 15. See also line 19. Why should he care if unspeakable outrages occur? The logic of such talk is, don't make me do X. I can't be held responsible if, and so on. Nobody forced King Henry V to invade France, and it's absurd to tell the French defenders of Harfleur, quote unquote, you yourselves are cause of the atrocities that stand to be committed against them. Act 3, Scene 4, line 19. Henry says all this, and more, in his attempt to justify potentially giving free rein to the worst impulses in human nature, an attitude we find Shakespeare condemning in his bleakest tragedies. The king hedges his own responsibility by saying that the men of Harfleur should capitulate, quote unquote, whiles yet my soldiers are in my command. Act 3, Scene 4, line 29. What Henry has said delivers to us some sense of the dreadful reality that we must contrast with Fluellen's War College ideal, the fearsome cry of havoc, meaning commit mayhem, is never far from an ancient battlefield. But the strategy works. The question, quote unquote, will you yield and this avoid, or guilty in defense be thus destroyed, is answered by the men of Harfleur with the opening of the town gates. Act 3, Scene 3, lines 42 through 43. When the governors of Harfleur give a suitable answer, the king orders that his men should, quote-unquote, use mercy to them all. Act 3, Scene 4, line 54. The coming on of winter and illness also drives him to declare a temporary retirement to Calais. Ils sont les mots de son mauvais, corruptibles, gros et impudiques, et non pour les dames d'honneur d'usée. Princess Catherine of Valois, Henry's future wife, learns some comically indecorous English from her maid, Alice. In Act 3, Scene 5, Catherine and her maid, Alice, practice their English. This is Agincourt's lighter side, with deep differences reduced to linguistic infelicities and embarrassments, culminating in Catherine's declaration that certain English words are not only ugly, but also corruptible, gros, et impudique, et non pour les dames d'honneur, d'usée. Act 3, Scene 5, lines 48 through 49. She means specifically the English words for le pied, foot, and la robe, gown, which the French ladies mispronounce as foutre and Lycaon. Their innocence contrasts with the English king's brazen references to sexualized violence in his Harfleur speech of Act 3, Scene 4. We also get a sense of what the wars between the English and French mean from a royal woman's perspective, though here that perspective consists in remaining oblivious. Aside from France itself, Catherine is the prize for King Henry. Not that Shakespeare depicts all royal Frenchwomen this way. Henry VI's queen, Margaret of Anjou, is portrayed as ruthless and sharp-tongued. "Go down upon him, you have power enough." "And in a captive chariot into Rouen, bring him our prisoner." Charles VI encourages his chastened generals to stop Henry V before he reaches Calais. The herald Montjoie is ordered to visit King Henry and discuss a ransom. In Act 3, Scene 6, the French commanders exhibit both shame for their poor performance in war thus far and continued contempt for their English opponents. The Dauphin scornfully reduces the English to the efflux of certain Frenchmen's acts of generation, calling them, quote-unquote, "a few sprays of us, the emptying of our father's luxury, our scions, put in wild and savage stock." Act 3, Scene 6, lines 5 through 7. All said, Shakespeare's high-born Frenchmen put too much stock in their own stock. Too much emphasis is put on chivalric words and titles rather than on deeds. King Charles VI is warier and smarter than that. He bids his ample army to stop prating and instead bring King Henry to him as a prisoner. Quote unquote, "Go down upon him, you have power enough, and in a captive chariot into Rouen, bring him our prisoner." Act 3, Scene 6, lines 52 through 54. Around 1415, France, even after the plague had killed perhaps one-fourth of its people, had around 14 million inhabitants. Compare that with England's 3 million or so. The advantage lay with the French. Late medieval France was a wealthier and more populous place than England, even if both countries were burdened with social and political problems. "We would have all such offenders so cut off." Pistol tries to enlist Fluellen to get Bardolph's death sentence for church robbing put aside, but Fluellen scorns the request. King Henry upholds the sentence and defies Montjoie's advice to offer a ransom for his own safety. In Act 3, Scene 7, Fluellen takes Pistol for an honorable soldier until the latter begs him to intervene for Bardolph, who is to be hanged for robbing a church. Quote unquote, "Let not Bardolph's vital thread be cut with edge of penny cord and vile reproach." Act 3, Scene 7, lines 43 through 44. Fluellen flatly refuses to honor this request. Quote unquote, "If, look you, he were my brother, I would desire the Duke to use his good pleasure and put him to execution." Act 3, Scene 7, lines 49 through 50. Fluellen is determined to expose Pistol. He cannot stand such a gap between appearances and reality, and says, quote unquote, "If I find a hole in his coat, I will tell him my mind." Act 3, Scene 7, line 76. Even though King Henry did not originally hand down Bardolph's sentence, he shows no compassion, saying, quote unquote, "We would have all such offenders so cut off." Act 3, Scene 7, line 96. Offenses such as sacrilege, riot, and advantage taking against the common people cannot be allowed when one is, quote unquote, gamester for a territory like France. Act 3, Scene 7, line 101. The herald, Montjoie, soon arrives and makes his master's demands, offering to show mercy on King Henry if he agrees to pay a large ransom. What the herald says by way of inflating the ransom's price comes very near to, "How dare you keep winning?" He says to Henry, quote unquote, "For our disgrace, his own person kneeling at our feet," would be, quote unquote, but a weak and worthless satisfaction. Act 3, Scene 7, lines 118 through 119. Henry refuses to pay ransom to the French king, pledging through the French herald only, quote-unquote, this frail and worthless trunk. Act 3, Scene 7, line 140. See lines 139 through 142. He tells the herald honestly, quote-unquote, we would not seek a battle as we are, nor as we are, we say we will not shun it. Act 3, Scene 7, lines 150 through 151. King Henry V places himself in God's hands as he says to Gloucester and gives orders to establish a camp past the river, with a march scheduled for the next day. I will not change my horse with any that treads but on four pasterns. The French commanders flaunt their prospects as the morning and the battle approach, praising their own war horses in the most fulsome and frivolous terms. In Act 3, Scene 8, the French rehearse their arrogance regarding the English prospects. The Dauphin follows Orléans and the Constable on the subject of their war horses. The heir to the French throne waxes poetical about his own cheval de guerre, saying, quote-unquote, I will not change my horse with any that treads but on four pasterns. Act 3, Scene 8, lines 11 through 12. The Norton gloss of pasterns is hooves. When the Dauphin leaves them to themselves, Orléans, Rambert, and the Constable jest about the Dauphin's supposedly deficient valor, and the Constable concludes with comic irony, quote-unquote, I think he will eat all he kills. Act 3, Scene 8, line 84. Thanks for listening. This audio lecture was recorded on Tuesday, November 4th, 2025. The foregoing material is copyright 2025 by Alfred J. Drake. For quotations, I have relied on the Norton Shakespeare 3rd edition 4-volume genre-based format.